Society. The court has two matters for us today, one at 2:30 and one at 3:30. We'll hear the case for today at 2:30. The panel consists of myself, Wade Birdwell. The rookie on the panel to my left here is Justice Walker, and the near rookie to my right over here is Justice Wallach. So if you'll go ahead and call the case, we'll get going.
The court will now call AQF Partners LLC versus Rogers Insurance Company. And may it please the court, Mr. Brennan, the chairman, to honor for the appellant, and Mr. Jay Peters, to argue for the appellant.
May it please the court?
Sure.
Good afternoon, members of the court. Allow me to introduce myself. My name is Brennan Kachera, and I represent the appellate, Hoff Partners, LLC. Attending today's argument is Mr. Jeffrey Ho, a corporate representative of Hoff Partners, LLC, and Mr. Benjamin Crowell, who's my law partner. Today's argument is going to be about agency law, and in particular, the imposition of statutory agency status under Chapter 4001 of the Texas Insurance Code. During today's argument, I'd like to present to you at least a brief recitation of the facts, discuss the black letter of the law, the legislative intent behind it, and what our Texas Supreme Court has said about the purpose and intent of that law. I would also like to discuss with you what Hoff Partners' position is, what Nautilus' position is, and why we believe it's incorrect, and why the trial court committed error. Ultimately, we're going to be asking this court to reverse and render in favor of appellate Hoff Partners, LLC. So the facts are this. Hoff Partners owns and operates three commercial buildings in Arlington, Texas. And in 2018, a retail agent named Summit solicited an application of insurance from Hoff Partners. Now, it's important to note that Nautilus does not dispute that Summit solicited an application from Hoff. And that application specifically contained a billing plan. The billing plan was supposed to go like this. Would be billed for the premiums. Summit would be responsible for collecting those premiums, and Summit would then be responsible for transmitting those premiums onto the carrier. Nautilus's corporate rep testified to this. Hoff understood this to be the basic transaction, and Summit's agent also understood that this were the fundamentals of this transaction. Now, this application that was containing the agency billing plan was actually forwarded to Nautilus. Nautilus reviewed it. Nautilus approved this application. And then Nautilus released their quote. It was accepted by Hoff, and Hoff paid its premiums. In exchange for payment of these premiums, Summit then provided Hoff with Nautilus Insurance Company's policy. Sadly, though, one portion of the billing payment plan did not take effect, and that's that Summit did not pay the premiums on.
Question.
Yes, Your Honor.
There were two payments due in March. Were those two payments a part of the quote, or were those two payments a separate agreement between Hoff and Summit as to how the payments would be made by Hoff to Summit under the circumstances?
I don't believe there's any evidence that it was a separate agreement. I believe it was, can we make the payment over two payments? And the answer was yes.
Well, but the question is how did that agreement come about? Was that part of some type of communication with Breckenridge?
No, Your Honor, that would have been a communication between Summit and Hoff.
Okay, but ultimately you're getting a quote from Nautilus through Breckenridge, okay? Is there anything in the record that indicates that the two payments that are to be made by Hoff in March were the permissible payments, or was the only thing there about the monthly payments? So my point is the transaction with regard to how the payments were going to be made to Summit part of any kind of transaction with Nautilus, or was that a separate individual transaction between Hoff and Summit?
I believe that was a separate individual transaction between Hoff and Summit.
And so Nautilus was just expecting the total lump sum at some point in time in order for policy to be effective.
That's my understanding, and it's also my understanding that both premium payments were made prior to their expectation of receiving payment.
Were the payments made prior to the issuance of the policy?
Yes. Well, one payment was made prior to the issuance of the policy. So I believe there was a $6,000 check that came in. And then once that $6,000 check came in, there's a letter dated March 7th, which is the day after the payment. And that's when they delivered the policy. And then the other payment was made thereafter. And I believe that was before, I'm sorry, I believe it's March 23rd, but it was towards the end of March of 2018.
And that's when the policy was bound.
That's when the policy was delivered, was bound and was delivered to Hoff by Summit. So I believe the court's familiar with the facts, so I apologize, and I'll be brief here. What ends up happening is that payment is never made, and unbeknownst to Hoff, the policy was canceled, and a few weeks later in June.
Well, the payment was made, but it was never transmitted from Summit to Breckenridge.
That's correct. The premiums were never transmitted. At a later date, they were, but at that time, they were not. And in May of 2018, the policy was canceled. In June of 2018, a terrific storm came through, did about $1 million worth of damage, and that's when the claim was submitted. During the claim investigation process, Nautilus looked into the claim, the premium payments, and actually told Hoff about this. Hoff dug up the checks that they paid to Summit, provided that to Nautilus, and said, no, I paid my premiums. So Nautilus, knowing that the premiums had been paid and knowing that they had liability under the policy, still denied the claim.
Who were on the checks? Who was the payee on those checks?
I would have to look into the record, but I believe it was Summit Insurance Agency.
Okay, so a check from Hoff with the payee being Summit, okay? Again, part of that agreement between the – okay.
And yes, sir, it was part of the basic transaction that Summit was –
the anticipation that Summit would then send a check to Breckenridge. Did what – how did that ultimate payment get made? Was that a payee to Nautilus, or was that a payee to Breckenridge, and then Breckenridge was going to then turn around and do some type of payment to Nautilus?
They paid it on to Breckenridge, Your Honor. In mid-June of 2018, they paid it. So the reason I point out these facts is because I believe they're undisputed, but they also have the making of statutory agency under 4001, which serves a very important purpose in Texas. Prior to the Texas Insurance Code's enactment, Texas law held that an agency had dual agency status, which meant that the agent was the agent of the insured for the purposes of procuring the insurance policy, but it was the agent of the insurance company for the purposes of collecting premiums and delivering the policy. And what this allowed for was a lot of disputes. It allowed for insurance companies to defend against liability, making pretty much the exact same argument that I believe Nautilus is making today, that's not our agent, and they had no authority. So when the legislature specifically created this portion of the Texas Insurance Code to impute statutory agency, according to Appleman on insurance, it was to make it as safe as possible for persons seeking insurance to deal with the agent as if they were dealing directly with the company itself. And our Supreme Court chimed in on the purpose of this statute as well and said the purpose of the statute was to vest agents with authority coextensive of that of the company and to remove all questions of the local agent's actual or apparent authority from the field of cavil or dispute.
Let me stop you right there. Is that language pertaining to a second lines situation that you just quoted?
I believe it's just pertaining to the purpose of the statute, 4001, and at the time it was Article 21 overall.
And when it was enacted, it codified only singular agency, or was there still some dual agency that's operative?
I believe it removed all doubt over whose agency it was, as long as the agent involved itself in enumerated acts, which is under 4001.052, merely soliciting an insurance application makes that agent the agent of the insurer and not the insured. And that's the black letter law that we're the language of the law that we're talking about.
It's the carrier's agent, not the individual client or business
that's right.
owner.
Yes,
right,
Your Honor.
Right.
And then 4001.051.
So even if there's not any relationship, is there any evidence that Summit had ever solicited any policy from uh, that ended up coming from Nautilus at all?
Other than this one, Your Honor?
Other than this one.
I'm not aware, no.
Okay, so basically, let's assume that Summit's never obtained a policy from Nautilus. What you're saying is the mere fact that they solicited Hoff with regard to let me go out and get you a policy with regard to that. Before they ever find a policy or a carrier, they're already the agent of whatever insurance carrier they end up collecting a policy from on behalf of the insured or the eventual insured that they've solicited.
Yes, actually, it's a two-step process. They have to solicit the application, and then the insurance later has to be placed with that insurance carrier. And then that is what then makes them the agent of the insurer instead of the insured in any future dispute.
So basically, you're wanting us to interpret it so that basically the insurance company, if they write the policy, will end up effectively accepting all of the risk of all of the negotiation going ahead.
If there's a dispute, a future dispute,
without
yes.
possibly knowing what was going on. Because right now, I don't think anybody's going to doubt that Summit's the bad person here. I don't think either side's going to argue about that. So the real question is does the law take that into consideration? Is there any evidence with regard to the legislative history that the legislature is like, okay, as between the insured and the insurance company, we're going to, through 4001, we're going to impose upon the insured, the insurer, the risk with regard to bad acting agents?
Just the secondary treatises that I cited, Appleman, there's also Texas Consumer Guide, and then, of course, the Texas Supreme Court case that I cited earlier. That's all I'm aware of describing exactly what the purpose of 4001 was, and, of course, the black letter of the law.
Let me preface this question by saying that it's a good thing the Texas legislature is not in charge of driving directions for Google, because trying to track their back and forth between these statutes is a challenge. But if you look at 4001, it starts out by its applicability. Except as otherwise provided by this code, this title applies to each person is licensed under, and I take it that Summit was licensed under subtitle B. Is that correct?
I believe it's C or D.
Okay. And but it also says that subchapter E, which is surplus lines, agents. Then if you go to 981, actually 981.222, applicability of other law, it says that in addition to the requirements of this chapter, which is 981, the administration and regulation of a surplus line agent's license is governed by Title 13, which takes us back to 4001, except that the provisions of, and in particular it says 4001.003, don't apply. Well, 4000.003 is the definition section. So if you don't have definitions of agent and you don't have definitions of insurer, where are we supposed to go to find what the definition of an insurer and the definition of an agent is for purposes of 4001?
I believe that's in 4001.003, where it does define insurers, which is anyone regulated by the department, and then agent, which is, and it lists a laundry list.
But 981.222 says those don't apply.
And if I could, Your Honor, I think what that statute is saying is that it doesn't apply for certain licensing requirements, and that's actually a good example where the legislature actually did carve out where 4001 doesn't apply. And
so it doesn't apply to surplus lines?
It doesn't apply to surplus lines agents.
Okay. So does it apply to surplus lines insurers but not their agents? Doesn't that seem a bit contradictory?
Well, I think the legislature, we presume that they use everything for an entitled purpose.
That's a good presumption.
I think they would have said this doesn't apply to surplus lines carriers, if that's what they meant. But instead they said this doesn't apply to surplus lines agents and only for their licensing purposes. And it really removed a few requirements, I believe.
Okay.
Well, it says do not apply to a license issued under the subchapter, and that subchapter applies to surplus lines agents. That's what you're saying, correct?
Yes, I believe it. What I'm saying is that it doesn't apply to certain licensing requirements, a requirement to get a license to be a surplus line.
Which I guess where I'm trying to figure out where this takes me is, does this take us to the situation that these definitions don't apply to surplus lines agents to make it consistent with the fact that everybody is supposed to be coming under 4001? Is that where they're taking us?
I'm sorry. I don't think I understand your question.
Why would they exempt? Why would the legislature exempt surplus lines agents from these definitions under 4001.003? Why would they exempt that out unless they're trying to say everybody's covered by the same rules?
I think I see what you're saying. I think they're only exempting them for certain licensing requirements. They're not exempting them from 4001 altogether, which is a very broad statute that talks about who is an agent if they engage in X, Y, and Z.
All right, counsel, close it up.
Your Honor, I think our position is that they were the agent under the black letter of the law, and payment to the agent was as good as payment to the principal. They should have never been canceled, and they should have had their damages paid for under this policy. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Jay Sever for Nautilus Insurance. I'm here with Steve Hayes and Casey Schulke. And we'll be responding, obviously, to the arguments that you just heard. I want to start with the cancellation itself. There really isn't any dispute that the cancellation was proper under Texas law. I mean, we've all agreed on the relevant facts there. So I think your questions have focused on the right.
In terms of the procedural matters that were done to effectuate.
Yes, sir. Okay. Yes, sir. The actual cancellation was appropriate given the timing involved and the requirements that Texas law makes all of
the grounds for cancellation was appropriate to a separate matter.
Okay. Yes. The question, I think, very specifically is whether by some legal mechanism, Nautilus can take the liability of Summit, who unfortunately doesn't have applicable insurance to deal with the problem we're having today. I mean, we're here because there is an argument that either by 4001 or some other way, Nautilus becomes Summit, and therefore the failure that Summit encountered in paying the premium somehow goes directly through the surplus lines broker and on to the insurance company.
If Summit was an agent of Nautilus as a matter of law, then what you're saying you wouldn't be saying what you're saying.
That's
correct.
That's exactly right.
Because you believe in your interpretation of law that they're not an agent of Nautilus, that everything you're saying is accurate.
That's correct. There, that sort of breaks down, that argument, that issue breaks down into a couple of different issues. One being whether 4001 creates an agency and completely ignores any other agreements that may be in effect, because there are no facts suggesting that there were any correspondence, any intent, any agreement, any contract of any kind between Nautilus and Summit. There just isn't. I mean, you all know the way surplus lines works. A retail agent doesn't deal with the insurance company at all. They deal with the surplus lines broker. We call them brokers.
Breckenridge.
That's Breckenridge. And that is the agent. That's the only way Nautilus can do business in Texas. They've got to have that person who is a licensed Texas agent. And so that person is the only one that is front-facing to Summit. So,
But you don't dispute that Nautilus did bind a policy initially. You agree with that?
I don't dispute that whatsoever. That it was canceled before the loss, and so what we're dealing with here is a policy that was canceled and not reinstated by anything. And so what you're dealing with in terms of the argument is whether somehow Texas law says we're going to ignore that cancellation because what Summit did wrong is what Nautilus did wrong. And the reason you can't do that is that 4001 doesn't get you there. 4001, whether you're looking at Section 51 or you're looking at Section 52, They both obviously apply to regulated carriers, which in this case must mean admitted carriers, the carriers that you see when you walk down the street and you see a State Farm.
So why does 4001.002 include agents licensed under subchapter E of chapter 981?
Well, all of 4001 clearly is meant to deal with agent licensing. And agent licensing does include surplus lines agents. It just doesn't include the provisions of the statute just don't include surplus lines insurers. Because when you try to apply either 51 or 52 to surplus lines insurers, you just get stuck. It doesn't work. It doesn't work factually because the surplus lines insurer has no agency relationship, cannot have an agency relationship with a retail broker. It's not just a factual fact. I mean, you all have seen the facts enough to know that there cannot be a communication directly between the two. But the intent of the legislature in 51, when they're dealing with the payment of premiums, clearly relates to an agency that holds the name of the admitted insurance company, you know, a State Farm, takes that premium and then pays it on to their agent, you know, the admitted carrier. Here, you're missing a step because the agent of the insured can only deal with the agent of the surplus lines carrier. And the payment of premiums, and this is important to the intent of the legislature, is actually dealt with in another code section, which is 981007, which deals with the payment of premiums and says that if someone in Breckenridge's circumstance, the surplus lines broker, receives payment of premiums, that is deemed receipt by the insurer, the surplus lines insurer. And so you can't really have that statute coexist with what Hoff is saying 4001.51 Section 6 says. It just, those two don't live together. They can't work together. And so if we're trying to discern what the legislature meant, I think we can only conclude that the provisions that we're talking about here, 51 and 52 and 4001, simply weren't meant to apply to surplus line carriers. There is a lot of argument about whether surplus lines carriers are actually regulated or actually, you know, can be held under to account by the Department of Insurance. I don't think that's the issue here. I think the real key issue to look at is, can you give the legislative intent
why can you not have a parent authority? For example, if you have an application which says billing and it's checked off agency, and agency on the front of the application lists Summit as the agency, and that is approved not only by the managing general agent, but also by Nautilus, why is that not an expression to the insured who's making the contract with the insurance company? Okay, their contract is not with the managing general agent. Their contract is with Nautilus. Why is that not a representation from Nautilus to the insured that billing process is what they've approved?
Because for purposes of payment of the premiums, the only agreements there in terms of that process are between Hoff and Summit. That is not...
What says that? What does the insured have in front of them that says that?
Well, the testimony, I think, that you've seen here makes clear that the payment plan was only agreed between Summit and Hoff. That no one went to Nautilus and said, will you please approve this
payment? It was part of the packet that they reviewed, according to the testimony I read.
Well, they had information that would have revealed the payment plan, but it's not one that they went to Nautilus to get approved. And Nautilus would not or could not. And they only act through, of course, their broker, who is Breckenridge. And neither Breckenridge nor Nautilus was part of the negotiations of the payments. And certainly, yes, they knew about it. But I don't think knowing about it gets you to actual agency. And there is nothing in the record suggesting that.
Why is that not a fact issue?
Well, I don't think that the facts are disputed at all, that when you're what you really had here was an agent, a retail agent, that negotiated a payment plan with an insured. I don't think there's a dispute there. And so if the court believes that the fact that the information of the payment plan coming to Nautilus is enough to bind it as an agent of Summit, well, then that's a different issue. But I don't think there's a dispute about those things at all. But, I mean, to get to the bigger point about the way agency works here, you've got to have some affirmative fact. I mean, you've got to have, if not a written contract, where Nautilus signs something that says you're our agent, which they do have to do with Breckenridge. You've got to have some conduct that suggests that Nautilus, what they're doing in acting as a surplus insurer, is somehow endorsing what Summit is doing. And there are facts that could have changed this whole outcome, and I think Justice Walker suggested some of them. I mean, if there had been communications directly from Hoff to Nautilus about the payment of premiums, if they had chosen, if there was a way they could have chosen, I don't think there was, but if
unlike a situation where your managing general agent handles this entire transaction without Nautilus's approval or interaction, and that does happen, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. In this case, your managing general agent said, this is beyond the scope of our authority. Okay, we need to send it upstream to Nautilus for their approval. That package went upstream, and that package came back downstream with an approval which says billing, crossmark, agency. Now, if an insured is looking at that, what is to tell that insured that that doesn't mean, well, I pay the agent, I'm done? What you may know that from your perspective as a lawyer representing the surplus lines agents, but from someone who's buying into that type of situation, what's to tell them that no, that doesn't mean what you think it means?
Well, I don't think that it, putting aside the fact that I'm a lawyer, I think that you heard from my colleague already that from Hoff's perspective, they knew their obligation when they chose agency was not to pay Nautilus, but was to pay the agent. And so I don't...
Well, that's the point, precisely the point that I'm making, is their perception of what billing slash agent meant was to pay the agent.
I don't think that that then moves us into the realm of anything in the statute that says that therefore somehow Nautilus steps into the shoes by statutory mandate into the shoes of Summit whenever
Summit
does something wrong.
I'm talking about in terms of a parent agency.
In terms of a parent agency, yes. I cannot speak to the subjective viewpoint of Hoff. And I don't know that there's that much in the record.
So how is this not an ambiguity which is going to require a jury to figure out what it meant?
Well, because I still think that based upon what you've been presented and what is uncontested in terms of the factual predicate, you have enough to know that there was no conduct, including the facts that you cite, that gave rise legally to enough agency authority for anything that the retail agent did to buy Nautilus. I just don't think it is enough.
We don't have a case on point with respect to that factual scenario, do we?
I think Vela is the closest case if you've looked at that one. I think that one is the closest because they unfortunately didn't look at the argument that we're making, which is that entire statute can't apply to surplus lines carriers. It's got to apply only to admitted carriers. But Vela looked at a very similar set of facts where the argument was made that any time the carrier endorses a policy by 4,001-52, any time the policy is solicited by a retail agent, that retail agent becomes the agent of the insurer. And they said, no, you've got to be able to prove that the insurer did something to agree that that retail agent was its agent. And that's what happens with admitted carriers. They do. That's why, you know, State Farm is on the door. That is the agent of State Farm. It's not the case with it just doesn't work when you've got the two different, you've got the agency relationship with Breckenridge, which is a contractual agency, and then you've got this removed carrier who's regulated differently than admitted carriers. So, I just don't think there is enough legally to support an agency argument, whether it goes to the jury or not. But back to the arguments that were presented to you, there's also an argument that I wanted to address about estoppel, right? That somehow the collection of a premium at the end of this that accounted for penalties and also the payment of during when the policy was in effect, that somehow acted as an estoppel or a waiver. There's nothing in Texas law suggesting that that's the way this works. If for some reason there was an overpayment made, if it's received after the cancellation of the policy, it cannot resuscitate the policy. It simply would be an overpayment that would be subject to a suit that you could make for overpayment. Here, the testimony is pretty clear that they charged a penalty and that they also tried to account for the amount of time the policy was in effect and then kept that amount as the appropriate premium payment. So I just wanted to make clear that particular argument doesn't work in terms of somehow reestablishing coverage. But let me make sure I've talked to you enough about the 981, because I do think it's important that we focus on what the legislature was trying to do in regulating and in addressing the surplus lines carriers under 981. I mean,
before you do that, sure. Let me ask a very general and abstract question, and pardon my ignorance if I'm not an expert on insurance law at all, but would you say that there is no ability for insurance companies to sell insurance at all in the state of Texas outside of a statutory scheme? Would you say that?
Absolutely.
Yeah, there's no way you can do business. There's no way you can offer that product unless you're falling under the insurance code.
I agree with that. Yes,
yeah, that's definitely, you agree with that, and that is your position.
I do, and it is, and here's why. And this is where we get to 981. I mean, there are really two kinds of insurance sold in this when we're talking about property and casualty insurance. It is either admitted insurance, where you go to the marketplace, sometimes solicited by a retail agent, as here, and when you cannot get an admitted insurance policy, you've got to then go on to the surplus lines market. And that's where we get into a whole separate part of the code and a whole separate area of Department of Insurance oversight. It's interesting because the Department of Insurance doesn't treat surplus lines carriers at all like they treat the admitted carriers. I mean, they don't approve language. You can make policy changes on your policies if you're a surplus lines carrier without getting approval of the Department of Insurance. There's a whole host of difference in treatment. And really what the Texas regime, like a lot of states, focuses on the regulation of the broker, right, the surplus lines broker, and making sure that broker is approved by the state, that they are registered by the state, which is why 4001 does apply to licensing of agents.
Well, let me follow up on that, because, again, going back to 981.2222, which says that the definition for surplus lines agents, the certain portions of 981 apply and certain portions don't apply. It takes out, for example, the definition section. It takes out subchapters C through G. It does not take out subchapter B, and subchapter B talks about acts constituting acts as agents. So why would you leave that in but take the others out?
I don't know the answer, to be honest with you, and I don't know exactly what the legislature was looking at there. I heard the answer of my
colleague.
You
may never get from Beaumont to Amarillo, that's right.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think the Google Maps has failed you on this one, because there may have been an intent to somehow make sure that what is captured in 981 is appropriately defining and addressing something that is not conflicting with what is in what is in 4001. But I can tell you that as it relates to the payment of the premiums, 981007 does specifically, in a much more specific way, address what happens with the payment of premiums than 4001.51 does. And I think that's important in terms of the way we have to construe these provisions.
But if the reason happened to be that it's just simply reinforcing that this portion only applies to actual agents, you would probably like that interpretation, wouldn't you?
We actually thought about that argument, to be honest with you, Justice Wallach, and I think that the vast majority of what is happening under 4001 is meant to only apply to agents and not at all apply to insurers. And I think that a lot of enterprising attorneys have taken the breadth of the provisions in 51 and 52 to somehow expand all of this well beyond licensing of agents. But I do think that when you look at 981 and the entire purpose behind 981, that is where we talk about applying Texas law to doing business as a surplus lines carrier. And there's nothing in that statute suggesting that somebody like Nautilus can be bound by a retail agent. And I think more fundamentally, there's nothing in the definitional section, if we're going to use it in 4001, suggesting that it is meant to apply, that whole section is meant to apply to surplus lines insurers. And I think regulated insurers, I'll say it again, there is meant to mean those who are on that list of admitted carriers.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Well, good afternoon again. I'm concerned that Nautilus's reading of the statute would have wide-ranging effects, in particular when they say that they can only conduct business through their surplus lines agent. That's correct. They can only place policies through their surplus lines agent, but that conflates who is their surplus lines agent for placing a policy and who can be their agent for wide-ranging, a variety of things. For instance, .051B9 says that anyone who adjusts the loss is their agent, and they can be liable for that. That includes Texas insurance adjusters, and it's long been the law in Texas that an insurance company, including Nautilus, can be liable for an insurance adjuster's actions if they violate the Texas insurance code. I would also like to address that.
Let me ask you a question real quick. Going back to just basic offer and acceptance law, what it seems to me is that you had the application solicited by Summit, sent up the line. So there's the amount, the application doesn't say we're willing to pay X month, X amount per month for X amount of coverage. It's basically we need this. Here's our information with regard to. It's basically soliciting a quote from an insurer. In this instance, it ended up being Nautilus, okay? So what came back down the line is the quote, which is effectively the offer of, we're willing to insure you for this amount of premium under the circumstances. And as Justice Wallach pointed out, the agency at issue is part of that because it's part of that quote. But that means there's two aspects to payment. One is the amount. The other is the method, okay? So what I'm hearing Nautilus argue is essentially that they can't agree by their very nature to accept the payment to the method that you're arguing right now, which is that they cannot accept a method by which they accept payment with Summit being their agent. So back to offer and acceptance. How do we interpret that quote as being that offer? In other words, that they've made an offer that they don't have a legal authority to make, as opposed to they're just saying, we don't care how you arrange to make the payment. If you want to do it through your agent, that's fine, but they're your agent, and we just want our payment.
And I believe the answer is anytime an agent engages in the enumerated activity, which is collecting or transmitting premiums, which is what happened here, that by law makes them the agent. I understand their position is that there's some trust account somewhere that once the money goes in there, that's how the policy's formed. But the basic transaction here was collect the premiums and then I'll hand you a policy. So it doesn't really jive with exactly what happened in this instance, Your Honor. I would also like to point out that my colleague stated that there essentially needs to be some sort of direct communication from the principal to the agent, giving them authority. That's not correct under current Texas law. The Supreme Court in the Orozco matter said an agency relationship does not depend upon express appointment or assent by the principal. Rather, it may be implied from the conduct of the parties under the circumstances, which is exactly what we're alleging here, and that apparent authority could arise through participation, knowledge, or acquiescence by the principal that clothe the agent with the indicia of apparent authority. And that's essentially what we've been arguing all along, is that you clothed the agent with this authority by once you viewed the application, okayed it, sent the quote, allowed him to collect the premiums, allowed him to deliver the policy.
And if there had been five middlemen all the way down to Hoff, your position would be that every single one of those would have become an agent, in essence, as long as that money was going up?
No, as long as they engaged in the enumerated activity under .051 or solicited an application under 052.
Okay.
Your Honor, I believe we made our point, and we're asking that you reverse and render judgment. On the one issue of forfeiture, we do believe there's a fact issue there, waiver of forfeiture. And that issue, in that instance, we're asking that you reverse and remand it. We do believe there's a fact issue there, and that should have went in front of the jury. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. The appeal is submitted. We appreciate y'all's arguments. They've been very helpful. And so we will adjourn from this particular argument. Thank you.
The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas.